Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, answers to your questions and emails, a little bit of everything. And before we go any further, I need to say that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's go first to some emails. We had a lot of interesting emails this week, and I want to be sure that we get a hold of them. First one is a follow-up from last week. This is from Kat in Boston. My friend is due to give birth in a few weeks, and I wanted to prepare her and her husband some pre-made frozen meals to take the edge off the first week once the baby is born. I have two questions. First, in general, are there any foods the mother should avoid while breastfeeding? Secondly, and specifically to my friend's case, while she has no food allergies, her husband has a large list of food allergies, including wheat, eggs, dairy, zucchini, blueberries, nuts, and oats. I'm not familiar with food allergies or breastfeeding, and I would like to know if I should avoid cooking foods with any or all of these items for fear that the baby might have a reaction somehow through the breast milk. Thank you very much for your insightful show. So, Kat, that's a really nice thing that you're doing for your friend, and encouraging her to breastfeed is a wonderful idea because it sounds like the baby's DNA contains a predisposition to allergies from the father's side. And one of the best ways to foil that predisposition is to reduce the stress of the infant and to breastfeed the infant, both of those. So having parents not having to worry about cooking, well, that's going to help the baby's stress and the parents. But more importantly, the breast milk contains compounds that help set the immune system, and the use also of infant probiotics would be something I would probably recommend in this child, because the probiotics also teach the system to recognize self and non-self. And there's more information on the Ask Dr. Dawn website under interviews in the archives. There's a Gerard Mullin, M-U-L-L-I-N. We interviewed him last spring, and we talk a little bit about that self-non-self recognition factor in his discussion of irritable bowel disease. So let me talk to you a little bit about that DNA. Dad's allergies concern me, and it makes me wonder if he might actually have celiac disease, in which case the baby has a chance of getting that. And the reason I say that is because of the large number of sensitivities he has. You typically see that in a person who has some kind of chronic ongoing damage to the bowel mucosa, something that allows food antigens to seep across and be exposed to the Peyer's patches, which are the immune system, like lymph nodes, but lymph nodes of the intestine. Especially the blueberries is a weird one. And so there is a DNA, well, not a DNA test, but a test for the HLA antigens, DQ2 and DQ8. We had another email from Marion about DQ2 and DQ8 because I mentioned them in the February 20th archived show, and she had a follow-up question. Part of your answer was that a negative test for certain HLA antigens would rule out gluten sensitivity. And I didn't hear what tests, if any, are definitive to diagnose the condition. So the thing about the DQ2 and the DQ8 are that these are markers like barcodes on the surface of the cells. They're used for pattern matching for organ donation. The immune system uses them to identify self and non-self. Realistically, only people who have either DQ2 or DQ8 can get celiac disease. So testing the baby and or father for that, logically you'd test the father first to see if he has that and then look in the baby. But either way, you could identify that. And if you had a baby with celiac DNA, or at least it doesn't mean the baby will get celiac disease or gluten sensitivity, but it does mean that you want to avoid giving that baby gluten early on. And that's certainly a child where I would be varying their diet and not letting them, you know, eat a lot of wheat products. I don't know that I would keep them away from wheat entirely, but I think that's too hard to do. But I would definitely not make it a staple of the diet. You could maybe want to be wheat-free in the things you cook for mom. but I don't actually think that gliadin gets into breast milk, so I don't really think you have to take that precaution. So let's do Frank in Pacific Grove asking about mold and asthma. 3 days ago, I did a couple of hours of hard work, raking, pulling weeds and the like. There were bags of oak leaves since this was the first time since the rain. That night, I felt my chest tighten. And ever since, I've experienced some flu-like syndromes, fatigue, muscle ache, low fever, and night sweats without respiratory problems or sore throat. Could this be a reaction to mold? And if so, is there anything I can do? Well, it could be a coincidence, or it could be a reaction to the mold. And either way, as I like to say to my patient, that horse done left the barn. But you might be able to avoid having that reaction again by using a dust mask. But like I said, it could be a total coincidence. Hard to say. And really, the thing that caught me about Frank was when he said his chest tightened. I don't know how old he is, but when anyone feels chest tightness after doing unaccustomed exercise, I just want to put out there, you should really have an EKG done. And if Frank is low risk for heart disease and has been getting properly screened by his primary care doctor, then I don't think he needs to necessarily call his doctor. But if he hasn't been, or if he's one of those people who's healthy and doesn't go to the doctor until he's not, this might be you're not so healthy. And the reason I say that is I have actually had people come in to the office and tell me last week they had the flu. And I checked them out, and they don't have any respiratory symptoms. So I'm like, yeah, I don't think it was the flu. And I'll put them on the EKG machine, and lo and behold, last week that flu was actually a heart attack. I don't want to scare you, Frank. You did say you had a low-grade fever, so you're probably right. It's probably the mold. But don't assume you know what's going on. I make a mistake every time a patient comes in, tells me what they've got, if I believe them, and I don't allow myself to consider other possibilities. One last email. This one from Anonymous in Michigan. Recently, I had a routine blood test taken after my physical revealed high levels of eosinophils. My doctor rechecked a month later and had gone up even more, from about 800 to around 900. The doctor had a stool sample taken, which came back fine. The doctor was checking for parasites, by the way, folks. He wanted to send me to an allergist, but I present no allergy symptoms, nor do I sense a change in my good health. When I asked him what else could be causing it outside of a parasite or allergies, he said, "Nothing really." Like a lot of people, I went and Googled it and came up with all sorts of scary possibilities. I know I probably shouldn't have gone there. I'm a male in my mid-40s and good health. Do you have any ideas? Thanks. Well, first thing, Anonymous, good advice from Dr. Dawn. Don't Google your symptoms, because you will find scary stuff out there. That being said, a high level of eosinophils can be a concern. Now, I didn't have the reference range for your lab, so I'm not sure how high 900 is, and they do score it differently. So let's suppose it's way above normal, say 2 times the upper limit of normal. I'd go see a hematologist. There are actually leukemia-like syndromes and leukemoid diseases that will show up with high eosinophils. And it's possible that you do have a parasite and that the O&P missed it. There are other types in other locations for parasites. I don't know your travel history. But I would work that up a little bit more rather than sit still if you can. It sounds like you do have healthcare access, so I'd chase that down. We'll go to our first caller now, Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi. Actually, I was thinking about a question that I wanted to ask last Saturday, but I didn't. But let me just start with the red yeast rice, which you probably know a lot about. If you could just kind of summarize what you know about it, in the sense that I'm taking a prepared tablet, and I'm taking 3 each time with a meal. So I'm taking at least 9, sometimes 12 tablets a day.
All right. So I don't know the strength of your tablets, and those vary quite a bit. So I'm going to answer your question without commenting on your dose.
Well, let me just grab the dosage real fast.
It probably won't tell me what I need to know.
The dosage is 1,200 milligrams per 2 tablets, so 600 each.
Right, but this is a food extract, right?
Right.
And so, depending on the method for extraction, the actual percentage of the active ingredient, which is lovastatin, isn't going to be clear. Typically, what the dose on the bottle gives you is around 5 milligrams of the chemical lovastatin.
That makes sense.
Okay. And 5 milligrams is less than the dose we would use in medicine. The thing to understand is that about red yeast rice, the biochemically active compound in there is the same as the statin Mevacor, which is lovastatin.
Right.
And that's where they got lovastatin. Drug companies are always going out there and looking at molds and yeasts and fungi.
I get that.
Yeah, I'm glad you do. So the dose that you're taking is probably around 5 milligrams.
Uh-huh.
It's got other things in it. And in general, it would seem to me that the other things are probably helpful in and protective and, if at worst, neutral.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's fine to use the red yeast rice, but you still want to take the precautions of checking your liver enzymes at least twice a year.
Oh, I do it every couple months.
Good, good. So your specific question was around dosing then?
Yeah, just as efficacy.
The efficacy is good.
You know, one tablet has got 5 milligrams, and the lovastatin that was prescribed to me was 20 milligrams.
Well, I'm not commenting on whether you're getting 5 milligrams because you can't tell me the percentage. I would call the company and I would ask for the percentage. What percentage of the 1,200 milligrams is it? Is it 10%? They'll tell you. They know. It's just not on their packaging.
Uh-huh. So between 20 and 30 milligrams would be safe, in your opinion?
Yes.
Okay.
Of the lovastatin. Yeah, and I mean, the maximum dose that I've seen used clinically is 60 milligrams. Of the statins,
well,
you can take up to 80.
I was ingesting lovastatin, the pharmaceutical drug, and I did a little experimentation. I stopped taking it, the lovastatin, and I pursued red yeast rice, and I think my total cholesterol reading was, I just had a blood test, 118.
That's total cholesterol, 118? Okay.
So that's pretty good, yeah?
Actually, that's too low, in my opinion. If your LDL is 118, low-density lipoprotein, that would be good. But a total cholesterol of 118 means that you probably don't have enough cholesterol to manufacture cell membranes or sex hormones. We don't usually like to push it that low. 140 is a good number.
Well, let's see. My good cholesterol, I don't have the results from me. My good cholesterol was 51.
I want to know if your total was really 118. I think that's too low, in my opinion.
125 went down to 202, lovastatin, and then mostly red yeast rice.
Okay, so now with the red yeast rice, it's 118. I think that's too low.
Yeah,
so you might need to back off.
Watching my diet.
What's your question? I mean, do you have an additional question? Because I need to go to...
Yes, when a person checks in to submit assistance from the emergency room, technicians, you know, the medical people.
Mm-hmm.
Is it customary if they want to do further diagnosis, analysis, whatever, testing? Do they get permission in writing from the patient?
No. In general, once you go into an emergency room, you're essentially signing a blank check, as far as giving either the physician's assistant or the physician a blank check to find out what's wrong with you and to do that in the best way they see fit as a clinician. So you're kind of trusting them.
So that's another blank check, their opinion.
Yes, it absolutely is. It's an emergency. You're not allowed to second guess somebody in an emergency and there's no time for discussion. Obviously that can backfire, but the assumption is that the individual who's providing the care is in an urgent situation and they're making a good faith effort to identify the cause of the emergency and keep the patient from dying. And if I find, let's say, for example, someone comes in with a headache and I find a neurological abnormality or they have a history of a blow to the head in the last 2 weeks, I will want to order a CT scan regardless of their ability to pay because I'm going to feel like we need that CT scan before I let them out of my emergency room. And especially if that's an individual without access to health care, because they're not going to be showing up in their primary care doctor's office in a week.
If I could interrupt you.
Sure, then that's
it. I have a primary care doctor. They were replicating and wanted to replicate tests. They wanted to admit me to outpatient and then into the hospital. And I was resisting and telling them that, you know, I wanted to know what the results of the test were, which they wouldn't tell me because it has to be done by a doctor, and the doctor is, you know, somewhere. So it was progressing. So finally, I just had to be adamant and say, look, this is crazy. I want out.
Okay.
And so I wanted to just ask about that. But you've helped me understand. Blank check, they get to do whatever they want within reason. And the reason is very ambiguous because, you know, hey, doctors are, you know, sit on the right hand of God, and no disrespect intended to you, Dr.
No, I understand what you're saying. And I also have to point out that the culture of emergency room physicians, as I see it, is that they are really afraid of being blamed for missing something. The assumption really is that they get from their academy and from their educational programs is if you miss it, you caused it. If you miss that heart attack, you're legally liable as if you went and shot the guy in the heart. And you're going to go down in a lawsuit if you don't look for the heart attack. And another group of emergency room expert witnesses says, oh yeah, he should have checked for the heart attack. Then you're gone. So they have a whole educational system predicated on how not to screw up by missing things.
Well, I thought my heart rate was a little bit too vigorous for bedtime. So they did an EKG. Of course, they wouldn't tell me what it was because the technician didn't know how to read it.
Yeah, the technician legally could read an EKG, but they're not, and they do. They learn how to do it, but they're not licensed to do it. Because they're not licensed to read it, they can't give you an interpretation. And an emergency room is a lousy place to get health care. It's a place where people who have emergencies go because they need care right away, but it's not a place that's designed on customer service. I'm going to go ahead and sign off now because we've got some other callers. Thank you. Let's go to our next caller, Erica in Pacific Grove. Hello, Erica, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm calling because I have a friend who lives in New Orleans. And I keep hearing that during hurricane season that possibly the oil and dispersants are going to go into the communities along Louisiana. And I'm just wondering how dangerous this is for her.
So are we all. Erica, what you ask is a really excellent question. And you'll probably remember 911, I think, for most of us adults, to those days of 911 and the week after that are seared into our memory. And one of the things that I remember very distinctly is at that point, my husband and I were both, he has a PhD in biology, and we were watching some of the early cleanup efforts and the search for bodies and stuff that was going on. And we noticed that nobody was wearing a respirator. And he kind of leaned over and looked at me and said, it's going to be a heck of a public health problem with all of these people in a few years. And I kind of thought about it and said, you're absolutely right. Well, the guys who are out there on the boats, you know, trying to clean up the oil, dealing with the dispersants, putting out the booms, the waves are happening, the wind is happening, it's all aerosolizing up into the air, and they're breathing it. They aren't using any respirators. And in fact, I heard an argument that against use of respirators by these individuals, because a lot of them are older in their 50s and overweight and don't exercise, and they might have a heart attack from exerting themselves using a respirator, so actually the respirators would be unsafe for them. And I'm thinking about this molecule, not just the oil itself. I mean, the oil itself is toxic. We know that you shouldn't inhale oil droplets. You can get a pneumonitis from that. And now we're adding a chemical which is a relatively new chemical. So when you ask how safe is it, the answer is nobody knows. The manufacturer doesn't know. The FDA doesn't know. The EPA doesn't know. Nobody knows. And we really won't know until we give the people who are being exposed to it, which unfortunately is going to include anyone in the coastal areas of the Gulf, at least to some degree, we won't know until we give those people who are exposed to it 5 or 10 years to develop whatever health problem it is that this stuff is capable of causing. And then, after we've done the experiment of 10,000 human guinea pigs who don't get sick after 10 years, well, then I can tell you it's safe.
Yeah.
But until then, some practical advice is if you're out there exposed to these things, if you're out there rescuing pelicans, you know, wear a respirator and walk slowly. And if you're not a healthy person to start with, don't be out there doing that because you are putting yourself at risk. And we really don't want you to do that. In addition, for people who are out there on the front lines, I'd go down to the Army surplus store and buy a respirator and just use it if you're going to go there. If you buy it and you furnish it, then I think from a liability standpoint, the contractors hiring you are off the hook because that's a personal choice on your part. And my God, isn't the Southeast of the United States the home of personal choice? I mean, in terms of our right to bear arms and all of that. Well, it's our right to bear respirators. It's, mm-hmm. it's maybe not in the Second Amendment, but it should be. And, you know, in storms and things like that, you know, stay inside. I think if there's a hurricane, obviously people are staying inside and trying very hard to not be exposed to those winds, and that's a good idea.
One thing I was thinking of is if they get a lot of flooding,
mm-hmm. yeah,
that will be in the environment and, everywhere.
And yeah, and then when it dries out, the residue will be yeah. will turn into dust, and everyone will inhale it. Like I said, the oil is bad enough. This stuff's a complete unknown, and it could turn out to be worse, or it could turn out not to be worse. We just don't know.
I think I'd advise her to move.
Well, if she didn't move after Katrina.
Yeah.
She's probably really loyal to her city, and she's probably going to stay right where she is, mm-hmm. health problem or no health problem. And we have to put these things in proportion. You know, an unknown is an unknown. It's spooky and psychologically unpleasant, but it's not as bad as a known evil. Mm-hmm. Does she smoke, you know?
No.
Good.
And she likes to rescue things, so I don't think she would leave.
There you go. All right. So in terms of your friend, thank you. I'm sorry it's not more helpful, but I think... For the most part, that covers what we can say.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. There was a very good special on the cleanup. You can look up the PBS program Need to Know, and their website is pbs.org/WNET/need-to-know. That is a really good show that tells it like it is, as much as is known about the cleanup issue and about the exposures to the workers. So good place to start. Maybe point your friend in that direction as well. Let's go to Lucia in Hollister. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is I was diagnosed with osteopenia about 10 years ago, and I've been taking Fosamax first daily, then weekly, and then monthly. And, most recently, Boniva, because the insurance company doesn't cover Fosamax anymore. What it's done is that it's really upset my stomach.
Oh, yes. Very common side effect.
Yeah, and I had an endoscopy.
Yes.
A week and a half ago or so. And the doctor says that I don't have an ulcer, but that I have a high level of acid reflux. And so I'm wondering if there's some alternative that's not, I can't remember what the medical term is for Fosamax.
It's a bisphosphonate, yeah. And the reflux issue is a class-wide effect.
It's a what?
It's a class-wide effect, which means uh-huh. all of the drugs in that class cause it.
Oh, okay.
If you go back and you look at the package insert and you look at the FDA approval for these agents, you'll see that gastroesophageal reflux disease, which you have, mm-hmm. is a contraindication. And what contraindication means is that the risk of using the drug outweighs the benefit of using the drug.
Oh, okay.
Okay. If long-term users of Fosamax and these other drugs, and this is what we've been talking about most of the hour already, is this idea that it takes a long time to develop certain complications. Well, a study recently came out linking long-term use of Fosamax and the other bisphosphonates to esophageal cancer.
Oh.
Okay? So you should not be using these agents. Once the person develops reflux, if they don't have it when they start, they need to find another agent. So other things that are available out there are selective estrogen receptor modulators. The trade name for that one is Evista. Evista. Raloxifene is the actual name of the drug. This drug is like estrogen as far as the bones are concerned. So it stimulates, it affects the osteoclast, it slows down bone reabsorption, but it is not an estrogen as far as the breast tissue is concerned. So it doesn't cause any increase in breast growth, and it doesn't cause breast cancer cells to grow faster. So that's a good drug to use for osteopenia to preserve bone mass. I also want to point out, if you're osteopenic and your bone scan shows that you're still osteopenic, you don't actually have a disease, osteoporosis.
Uh-huh.
So you're taking a drug which might cause cancer in order to prevent a disease you don't have.
Oh, wow.
Not good logic as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Very, very standard issue medicine, but it's because we think in terms of, oh, we have this agent and we can prevent the progression to this disease. But in your situation, you have a direct contraindication. Even if you had osteoporosis, I would be reluctant to put you on this. And you don't even have the disease for which you justify the risk.
Right.
All right. So look into the selective estrogen receptor modulators. Let me just run through the list.
Okay.
Because you can go back and you can listen to the podcast and write these things all down.
Okay.
But the other things that are really important are making sure that you're absorbing your calcium and that you're taking enough calcium.
Mm-hmm.
So 500 milligrams three times a day. So 500 milligrams with each meal plus vitamin D. I'd probably check a vitamin D level and make sure that your blood vitamin D level was at least 35. And if it isn't, then I would try to get it there by using supplements.
You said 35 milligrams?
No, 35, I think it's nanograms per ml. It's the measurement of the concentration of vitamin D in your bloodstream.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And depending on how low it is, like if your level were 18, I'd put you on 5,000 units of vitamin D a day. If your level were 28, I'd probably put you on 2,000 units a day. So how much supplementation one uses depends upon how far you need to get the person into the range. And I use blood levels now because I see a lot of variation in terms of what it takes to get people there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second and important piece of this puzzle. Adequate calcium, adequate vitamin D, adequate weight-bearing exercise, which means walking or jumping rope or something that bounces your body every day. A good way of thinking about it is if you have breasts that bounce when you jump, you need to be jumping hard enough to make your breasts bounce.
Okay.
It's like jumping rope or jumping jacks or going down up and down stairs. I mean, about that amount of force will stimulate bone formation. So that's also very important. Now, the other drug class that's available is Forteo, which is a calcitonin-like drug, which means it takes calcium in your bloodstream and it pushes it into the bone. And Forteo is only given by injection. It's only approved for severe osteoporosis, but we are seeing, as usually happens, off-label use. This is a powerful agent, and I don't recommend it for you. I'm just, for the sake of completeness, putting it out there. If someone with more severe osteoporosis who couldn't take the bisphosphonates, that might be where I would go. All right?
I'm really glad you told me this. I wasn't aware of the cancer-causing study that was done.
Yes, it's esophageal cancer, and it's because the Fosamax is an irritant. The bisphosphonates are irritants. If you're refluxing and you get that irritant up in your esophagus, plus the acid, it's a recipe for badness. It causes injury, and chronic injury in this situation is what causes the cancer. So other issues around the bisphosphonates that are emerging now that they've been around for long enough is problems with bone not behaving normally, because obviously we are altering the structure of the bone with these drugs. And so bones don't heal as well as they should. If you break something, if the dentist needs to drill into your jaw because you have tooth decay, you don't heal as well. Recently, a study showed that certain very rare fractures of the leg are becoming less rare in long-term users because their bones are no longer the same. And so the physics of the bone has been shifted by these agents. So over the long term, I think we're going to pull back from the bisphosphonates and start using them maybe 5 years on with a 1 or 2 year drug holiday to allow for some bone remodeling. Maybe switching people from the bisphosphonates to a CIRM and back and forth or some other strategy. Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I appreciate the call. It was very timely.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. A couple of quick news items here before we go to the next caller. Let me start with a health insurance action alert notice that I received. And this is a California Assembly Bill 2578. It's called the Healthcare Affordability Act for the state of California. It's sponsored by State Assemblyman Dave Jones. And what it will do is limit rate increases by the insurance industry between now and 2014 when the Healthcare Accountability Act that was passed at the federal level in March of this year actually kicks in terms of the rate protections. A lot of those things were phased in, and nothing actually will really happen until after the next presidential election that will benefit the population at large. And enough said about that. Anyway, you could help by calling State Assembly Speaker John Perez and Assembly Appropriations Committee Chair Felipe Fuentes today and urge them to release this bill and let it go to legislature. I will post the numbers on the website, and that's something you could leave on somebody's voicemail over the weekend if you feel strongly about that issue. This article just out, stem cells turn into seek and destroy cancer missiles. This is a very, very elegant strategy. Stem cells, neurological stem cells, have a tendency to home in on cancer cells in the brain. This has been demonstrated in brain cancers in lab animals. And what is probably going on with that is that the cancer cells excrete messenger signals that are only seen in embryological situations. Cancer cells are essentially devolved cells that have reverted to a more embryological format in terms of what DNA they're expressing. So it's natural, birds of a feather flocking together, that stem cells would be attracted to them. Now, what researchers working with the City of Hope in Duarte, California have done is they've taken neural stem cells derived from human fetuses and then genetically engineered them to produce an enzyme called cytosine deaminase. Now, this is an enzyme that turns a drug called 5-fluorocytosine, which is not dangerous and not a chemotherapy drug, into an active chemotherapy drug called 5-fluorouracil. Having done that, the stem cells are injected into the area around the brain where the brain tumor is removed, and then the 5-fluorocytosine is injected into the bloodstream. This is not a toxic agent. It goes around, it circulates, it goes through the blood-brain barrier. Once it gets to the part of the brain where the tumor is, the stem cells are there with the enzyme and convert it into an active chemotherapy drug. So you get a very high level of chemotherapy drug right where you want it, targeted therapy, and the rest of the body doesn't suffer any side effects because the agent that's being infused is not a DNA poison to the rest of the body, only where you have that enzyme. It's a very neat and elegant trick, and it would also logically go after any metastases or micrometastases for exactly the same reason. The stem cells will home in on them even though we aren't able to see them with our imaging. It's a very elegant and, I think, promising cancer therapy, and I wanted to bring it to your attention just because I like talking about the good uses of stem cells now that we finally have a chance to really work with them. And let's go now to Cody in Monterey. Hello, Cody, and thank you for waiting.
Yeah, so I had a question about, I'm thinking about going to a physician's assistant school, and the school I'm thinking about in particular requires 3,000 hours of direct patient care before the application deadline.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, direct patient care.
Did they define that for you? And what exactly is direct patient care? Like volunteering at the hospital count or what?
Yeah, it can be paid or volunteered. And this is through the Stanford Medical School, and they do it with Foothill College, their PA program. And they'd like to see with underserved populations, like at least some work with underserved populations.
Uh-huh.
They define it. So like, for example, if you're an EMT in an ambulance, whatever, the time that you are waiting and transporting doesn't care. You actually have to be directly in contact, taking blood pressure.
Sure.
Doing
sure.
That sort of deal.
So what's your question?
Okay, so I'm an EMT, and I've done a little bit of medical stuff, like worked on ski patrol, different ski resorts for past winters, but in 3 seasons that I've done that, I probably have like 20 hours of patient care.
Okay, I see your problem. So
yeah.
You're looking for ideas for how you can rack up those patient care hours. How much time do you have before the application deadline?
Oh, well, no, I haven't even applied. Like, this is pretty, I'm trying to plan ahead as much as I can.
Okay. All right, so we're not under the wire here.
No.
All right, well, some thoughts. This one's kind of fun. I did this when I was in medical school, and my niece, who is an EMT, has done it. There's an organization called Rock Medicine where you provide medical care at first aid booths at rock concerts.
Oh, wow.
And you get into the rock concert for free. So bring your earplugs.
Right.
But that's a nice way, and you could volunteer for something like, you know, being on the front lines, and you'll be doing blood pressures, and the whole time would count as direct patient care. There are public clinics, they're private clinics, but they get grants from the state. So San Benito Health Foundation is one near you that I know of, and there's probably others in, I think you're in Salinas, if I remember correctly, right?
Monterey.
Monterey. So you could call up CHOMP and find out what the feeder clinics are. The emergency room triage nurse can tell you where people are doing volunteer health care. If you show up at a place and say, look, I can take blood pressures and take histories and I could help out, and, you know, I just want you to sign up on my hours so I can make up these hours. There's plenty of places where you can do some good and where there's plenty of patients, so you can rack up those hours so that every hour you spend is an hour of patient care.
Yeah.
So I don't think you'll have any problem if you go in that direction, going
okay,
out to the public clinics.
So, yeah, that's, I guess our thought, too, was something, yeah, where I can be kind of triaging people and, yeah, like clinics, you were saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any specific clinics around that?
Well, let's put it out there to the audience. Like I said, most of the private ones that are community clinics, but
yep,
they're not county-owned clinics, because once you're dealing with the county, then you're talking about county employee and unions and all this other stuff. And the private community clinics are really run on a shoestring. They have grants from the feds, and they have to oversee those grants. But if somebody shows up and says, you know, I can do blood pressures and here's my EMT certificate, I can legally touch a patient,
yep,
they'll be really happy to let you work for free.
Okay.
They'll be jazzed.
Awesome.
So I'd start... The local emergency rooms always know who and what the local clinics are and how they work.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Don.
Thank you for the call and for your generosity and being willing to go out and do it for free.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Bye-bye. Yeah. Let's go to Julie in Capitola. Hello, Julie, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm going to be losing my health care on July 1st.
How old are you?
Well, I'm going to be eligible for Medicare in August 11th.
Okay, so
I have a year to go, a little over a year, and I'm not going to have any health care. The COBRA is too exorbitant, except I know there was this COBRA Relief Incentive Act, but I had to have been terminated by 531. I don't know if that's been extended yet.
I believe it has. So I think you might be eligible for your COBRA, but the cost is...
It's still going to be,
a big issue.
A lot, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to afford it. So I'm having a quick surgery. I found out my meniscus was torn on Friday, and then I'll be kind of, I don't know how mobile I'll be after that, but I have this next week. I've tried to see all my doctors.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any major health problems? This is an orthopedic issue, but...
I have orthopedic issues.
But not diabetes, hypertension?
No, except I had, like, at a health fair, I ended up with about very close to the pre-diabetic level, close to, I think, 100 for the glucose.
Okay. That's not worrying me too much.
Yeah. My cholesterol tends to be, like, over 200 usually, but usually my HDL, that's a good one, right?
Yes.
That usually is pretty high.
Okay.
So I had one at the health fair, and then I had my doctor do one, and my HDL was lower, and my ratio had changed from 2.7 to 2.9.
Yeah, well, that's still a very good ratio.
The LDL was a little higher.
Yeah. I tend to think that the ones that are done on whole blood specimens in tubes are going to be more accurate than the finger stick pipette ones that they do at the health fairs.
Yeah, that's how
Okay, so just to kind of clarify your question, if I were to frame the question is,
what are my do in the next week?
Yeah, what can
and
I,
what, yeah, what
what's
are
strategic?
The things,
okay, so that, mammogram, when was your last mammogram?
I'm about to have one on Monday.
All right. So, and when is the absolute last day that you could opt for COBRA for a month?
I am not certain about that.
Find out. Okay. Find out Monday.
Okay.
Because I'm going to give you the nightmare scenario here. The mammogram comes back with something, but we're not really sure what it is.
Yeah. Let me clarify. I'm having it not this Monday, but the Monday before the 2 days before the 30th. And I'm not even sure, you know, it might not be read until the next day. And that's what I was worried about.
Yeah. And you should be worried about it because so be ready essentially to write a check or call in with a credit card number and buy yourself another month of coverage. Now, when you buy COBRA, you buy it month to month.
I see.
So you could maybe not afford it for a year,
yeah.
But you might have to afford it for a couple of months going forward until you tie up all the loose ends.
Yeah.
Do not drop coverage and then expect to get it back.
So, yeah, the problem is my insurance plan is also changing as of July 1st.
That actually doesn't matter as long as you don't have an interruption in coverage.
Okay, but the thing is that the plan is now a $1,000 deductible. All tests have to be paid for.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how bad a plan it is.
Right.
Doesn't matter what it costs.
Yeah, okay.
Until you know that everything is clean.
Not that I don't have any problems, yeah.
Because if something happens, you know, let's suppose that, yeah, the mammogram's suspicious for breast cancer.
Yeah.
You're going to need surgery. You might need chemotherapy. And you are a leper. You are an insurance
yeah.
leper.
Yeah.
So if you've got an interruption in coverage, you can bet that mm-hmm. you're going into your savings and you're selling your house
mm-hmm.
to take care of your breast cancer. Shouldn't be that way. Completely stinks
yeah.
that's your dilemma.
Yeah.
And you are one of literally millions of Americans who are having to make these bizarre strategic limbo kinds of decisions in their life because of this current situation. And it all goes away in 2014.
I know. It's unbelievable.
But that's 2014. That's 4 years away.
Doesn't help me.
It way doesn't help you. And it's just like Moses looking at the promised land and it's across the desert and it's like,
long way.
Damn, why can't I get
yeah.
there?
It'll be irrelevant by the time it happens.
Well, by the time it happens, you'll have Medicare.
Exactly.
So anyway, in your situation, you know, I still would say if you can look in terms of what you can switch to, you might be able to take a very high deductible, and I'm talking like $10,000 deductible, just so you don't lose the house if you're something drastic happens. Other things that you can consider doing, you know, think about what are the issues that might happen to me. And car accident is always high. Mm-hmm. So you could increase the car insurance coverage. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you have the absolute best.
Yeah, I think it's pretty high already.
Yeah, so that way, at least if you get hurt in your car crash,
right.
you can go after that
right.
car insurance as a source for some of your costs and
yeah.
things like that. But it's a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right to try to tie up all the loose ends.
Yeah.
And you won't think of everything, and hopefully nothing will happen.
Yeah.
But do the obvious stuff, and you're doing it. So
yeah.
good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I want to just quickly cover a quick email. And this was from Tom in St. Louis, who says that he gets sleepy when he takes his multivitamin, which comes from a large warehouse club, presumably Sam's Club or Costco or something like that. We don't know. He found that he was getting sleepy after he took his vitamin. He also took vitamin D and fish oil, but he figured out it was the multivitamin. And he was wondering if other people get sleepy on multivitamins. And yes, multivitamins are reported to cause some people to be sleepy. I don't know what the mechanism is and wasn't able to find any medical explanation for it, but I found a lot of anecdotal reports of exactly that phenomenon. My suggestion for Tom is that he go to a different brand, go to a high-end, expensive health food store brand of multivitamin and see if that makes you sleepy as well. Do that as an experiment. And yes, I would like all people over 50 to be using a multivitamin because I think that it's a good bet that you may not be absorbing all of the nutrition you need from your diet, even if you're eating a really good diet, which honestly, most of us aren't. Let's go to Morris in SoCal.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a little friend. He's about 10 years old. He was having a very hard time at school, and so they put him on Strattera. Strattera, 40 mm-hmm. milligrams.
Yes.
And he did pretty good in school. He still has his, you know, problems of paying attention a little bit. And, you know, you go tell him to pick. He's 10 years old.
Sure.
And
so what's the question?
I was wondering, like, is it a good idea to take him off it in the summer and let him mellow out or whatever? I don't know much about it. He's just, I'm a godfather guy.
Well, it depends upon how radical his behavior was, if it was just school issues or if he was just driving his parents crazy at home.
Uh-huh.
Some children, especially the ones who have hyperactivity along with their ADD, can be very, very disruptive in the family situation. But in general, in the summertime, you farm them outside, have them go play and physically exercise. And that is really helpful, taking your godchild out for hikes, because I have noticed that being out in the country, particularly around trees and in the woods and camping and those sorts of activities, are really wonderful for children with ADD. They blossom in those circumstances. And it's always good to take a drug holiday and let the body metabolize and get back to normal. And particularly, I think, in growing brains, very, very useful to do, if at all possible.
Okay, thanks. He's pretty good at it. I mean, he loves going outdoors, and I'm not trying to teach him in a classroom situation either. But, I mean, I think that sometimes kids grow out of it, maybe.
Oh, yes. And like also, you develop neurologically. And so as you get older, things do improve, and especially if they're working with him for structure and habits, and there's all sorts of tricks that can be done behaviorally for children with attention deficit that will help them. So hopefully he'll develop the neural circuitry. Remember, before we discovered ADD, generations of people grew up with ADD, and they were managed for the most part to find jobs and be productive members of society.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's totally hope.
Yeah, okay. Right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
for your program.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Quick off-air question. Artificial colors in the ingredients for multivitamins, is the quantity too low to worry about or not? You know, realistically, probably it's something your body's going to be able to process, but why do you need artificial colors and go find a vitamin that doesn't have them? And let's go to Ellen in Pacific Grove. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Yes, I am calling about a health concern that my 27-year-old son just found out about, and that is that he has the B12 in his system is extremely low.
How old did you say?
About half of what it is supposed to be.
How old is he?
He's 27.
Go ahead.
And he'd been feeling extremely tired and lethargic and headachy, and he had asthma, but you know, a little bit more asthma symptoms than usual. So
he has a low B12, and what is your question about that?
Well, and the low number came even after he'd had a B12 shot, like 5 days before. So he was advised to take a supplement.
Yes.
And then come back in 6 months and see how it is. And I'm just wondering, is there any, it's sort of unusual, it seems to me, for a young person when you have a varied diet to come up with this. And I'm just wondering, are there any other things that we should be concerned about now that we should be careful with or look into?
Yes. The first thing to be concerned for is that he may have the early stages of something called pernicious anemia.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that it was in the olden days called pernicious anemia was it didn't get better with iron, so it hung around, which means stubborn, mm-hmm. more or less. So it was the stubborn anemia. And the reason it hung around was because it was low B12, not low iron. We require a protein called intrinsic factor, which is excreted by the cells in the stomach, the parietal cells, and then it gloms onto the B12, and then there has to be acid present. And in the presence of both acid and intrinsic factor, you're able to absorb the B12. So it's like you have to go in there and hook the fish being mm-hmm. B12, and then pull it out of the water, pull it out of the stomach. Some people develop an autoimmune disease where they don't produce intrinsic factor. Those cells that would be producing it are damaged, so they can't fish because they don't have a hook. They can't grab the B12. He may have that, and that could account for his low levels. If he had a disease of the small intestine that impaired the absorption of the intrinsic factor B12 complex, he might also have a problem, and that would be something like bad celiac disease. He'd probably have more symptoms, so I don't think we have to go there just yet. A way around that is to take the B12 either by injection or to put it under the tongue.
Right, that's what we have.
And so if he's on a supplement and he's taking sublingual B12, you should see those levels come up. And I would watch for that over the course of several months. I probably would not wait 6 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
I would look in like 2 months and make sure that there's a sustained bump in the levels.
Okay.
And then if there's not, then he may have to go with regular shots. He may have to, you know, learn to self-inject if he can't get by with the sublingual B12. But it's very important not to walk around with low B12 levels. Other things that can interfere would be if he's taking any kind of acid blocker like Prilosec or Prevacid or anything for stomach upset, and if he is a heavy drinker. So we're out of time, so I won't be able to let you ask any follow-up questions.
Okay, that but helps
I hope,
very much.
I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. You can send me an email at askdrdawn.com, or you can call in next week here on the program. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.